Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Thursday Night Grueling Truth NFL Football Show. I'm your host, as always, Mike Goodpaster, and I want to welcome in, as always, my co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage. How you doing, Matt?
I'm very good, Mike. Hope you're having a good day as well.
Yes, I am. We're supposed to have Kenny Easley as a guest tonight. He was supposed to be in last week. We had problems with the Blog Talk Radio. Don't know if that's an issue right now or not, so hopefully Kenny will be with us shortly. I know I made the announcement Tuesday night on the boxing show with Joe Rodriguez and myself about the fact that we were now with NGSC Sports. All of our shows you can hear on the TuneIn app, iHeartRadio. I think we'll also be moving away from Blog Talk Radio, hopefully by next week, so maybe we don't have the issues with people calling in like we do right now, where people can't get in. I mean, this is definitely a big thing for the show, Matt, don't you think?
Yeah, what's really great about it is, we have access now to some larger networks like iTunes, Spreaker, Tuned In, I believe Stitcher is possibly one of them, but especially iHeart. That really gives the show a lot more exposure. There's a lot more ways for everyone to listen in, and we hope to continue to deliver lots of great guests and great content.
Yeah, and hopefully if we get away from Blog Talk Radio, all those great guests will be able to get through. So, so right now we're waiting for Kenny Easley to call in. Hopefully he will. So I'm sure, as always, Matt's the one that's always prepared. What's your backup topic, Matt?
Well, I always get a little it's always nice to be put on the spot, but I do what I can here, so waded through a few topics, and basically, who are the top 10 quarterbacks you would want in a two-minute offense in a pressure situation? Doesn't matter if it's regular season or playoffs. Obviously, some are going to be better than others when you consider the playoffs. But if you got to win the game, who are the guys that you would want in a two-minute offense to win the game?
Do you have a top 10 list for that?
Well, Mike, as a matter of fact, I do.
See, I told everybody out there, you're always the one that's prepared in the event of a catastrophe. So, not that this is a catastrophe,
absolutely.
You know. I mean, it's not like the California earthquake in 1989 or anything. But
no.
It's close,
nothing like
though,
that.
Because, I mean, I really wanted to talk to Kenny Easley.
Same here. Hopefully we'll hear from him. So,
what's your number 10?
My number 10 all-time two-minute offense, Steve Young.
Okay,
Steve Young,
wait a second, Matt. You're not just going to rattle off
10 49ers.
49ers. Quarterbacks like,
right. Now, see, but here's the problem, Mike.
All your lists are top
10
49ers, though.
If I list Steve Young higher, I'm accused of being biased. He's my number 10. He's the bottom of the list. But
I don't remember
really
a great Steve Young comeback.
You don't remember a great Steve Young comeback?
No.
What, so I got to come up with a 22-point comeback like Jeff Garcia?
No, just give me a good comeback. And you can't bring up the Bengals game.
Well, I didn't say it was a comeback. Remember, this isn't a comeback.
Well,
this
I mean, the last 2 minutes.
Offense.
Give me a last 2 minute drive. Well, what?
Okay.
Was he the quarterback through the pass to Terrell Owens?
Yes, he was. That was a fantastic 2 minute offense. Another one against the Saints, a key Monday Night Football game in 92. Steve Young didn't have a lot of fourth quarter comebacks, but they were down by a lot and he came all the way back. But he did, on several occasions, lead them down with 2 minutes to go and throw the game-winning score or lead them to a game-winning field goal situation.
Okay, so we're not going to greatest comeback quarterbacks. We're going to greatest last drive quarterbacks, basically.
Yeah, basically, if you got 2 minutes left, you need a score. Who do you want leading you? Steve Young's my number 10.
Well, I think we can hold off on that for a second. We got a caller. This Kenny?
Hello. Yes.
Yeah. How you doing, Kenny?
I'm doing fine. How are you tonight?
All right. I'm Mike Goodpaster. I'm one of the hosts with Matt Andruscavage. Matt's on here, too. You want to say hi to Kenny, Matt?
Hi, Kenny. This is Matt. Really good to have you on tonight.
Fantastic. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. I mean, to the listeners, we've got, I mean, I think one of the top three or four safeties in the history of the NFL. Kenny Easley is our guest tonight. Great to have you on the show, Kenny. Let's just start off with, you know, let's go back to your youth. What made you fall in love with football?
Well, I played all the sports. I played baseball, basketball, and football, and ran track, and I believe that doing those things, all the sports, not only helped me develop, athletically, but it made me competitive. I mean, trying to learn how to play, the various sports. So I really thought, for a long time that my best sport was basketball. I mean, that was really the sport that I loved and that I wanted to play. But as I got into high school, it was, I only grown to like 6'2", and no way I was going to be anything other than a shooting guard or a point guard or something like that. And in high school, I played center on our basketball team at 6'2", and we had two guys that were taller than I was, but because I could jump higher, I was the center. So anyway, so I wasn't going to get any taller, and I was playing football, and football came, fairly easy for me. But I think it really helped with my competitiveness, and I try to talk young kids out of specializing. Today I see so many young kids trying to specialize in one sport. I think it's such a mistake that when a 9-year-old kid is going to specialize in baseball, or he's going to specialize in football. I mean, play all the sports. I mean, that's how you become competitive, and that's how you learn how to play. That's just my opinion and the way that I sort of went about deciding what I was going to do.
Well, so you played a lot of the sports, give you basically a well-rounded ability to play a number of things. At what point did you know that, football is the way that I want to go? And at what point did that become reality for you?
Like I said, basketball was my thing, but I wasn't going to get any taller, so... I kind of knew early on. I mean, I didn't think, I didn't have anybody in my family in my immediate family that was probably taller than 6'2". And I think I reached that by about the ninth grade. I was pretty much headed, in the direction of football all along. And, I mean, I like football, but I thought I was a better basketball player than a football player. But football was, just like basketball, came easy for me. The interesting thing is that I really decided early on that if I was going to play football, I wanted to be a defensive back. I mean, I also played quarterback. I was a quarterback and a safety in high school and in little league and so forth. But I never wanted to be a quarterback. I mean, and I can't. And people have asked me, you know, why don't you want to play? You know, why didn't you want to play quarterback? And I think I was smart enough to know that I was just a good athlete playing, you know, playing the position quarterback. But at safety, you know, I was not only a good athlete playing the position, but I was good at it, and I enjoyed it. And I was better than most other people. And that wasn't the case at quarterback.
Who were some of the biggest influences in your football career as a young child, maybe high school, college, pro?
Well, as a young child, it was my father. I mean, my dad, he coached, you know, all of my little league teams and peewee teams and football and so forth. So I don't think I had a coach, another coach other than my father until I got into junior high school. And and then when I got into high school, my high school coach, Tommy Rhodes, was big influence on me because he sort of helped me, you know, shape my career as to what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. Although he wanted me to play quarterback, he thought I was good enough to play quarterback at the college level. And so did a lot of other coaches because when, in fact, I was recruited by more coaches as a quarterback. The final two schools that it came down between, which was Michigan and UCLA, both Bo Schembechler and Terry Donahue wanted me initially as a quarterback. But when I told them that I didn't want to play quarterback, I mean, you know, both gave me the oddest look you could never imagine, that some kid who is getting an offer to play quarterback at a major university don't want to play quarterback. He wants to play defensive back. And the deal maker was, oddly enough, my mother said, you know, well, he wants to play safety. So if I turn him over to either one of you coaches and you get him on campus, are you going to switch him to quarterback when you get him on campus? And Bo Schembechler, you know, honest as the day is long, said, "Miss Easley, I can't make you that promise that we're not going to do that because we believe right now that if we had him at quarterback, you know, we can win the Big Ten." And Terry Donahue said to my mother, "Miss Easley, if your son wants to play defensive back, safety, that's what he's going to play." And he said, "I feel that, you know, Kenny is going to be, you know, by his senior year, he's going to be an All-American safety. The only problem with that was that, you know, Terry Donahue was just a couple years off, you know, because I became an All-American my sophomore year."
So how did you end up deciding on UCLA?
Yeah, I, you know, like I said, it was Terry Donahue's decision to tell my mother that if he got me on campus, he would not switch me from, you know, free safety to quarterback. That if I wanted to play defensive back, then that's what I was going to play. And I mean that was the deal maker. I mean once he said that to her, she sort of gave me a look, and I gave her a look like, you know, that's where we're going. And I remember there were several coaches in my high school that thought that it was not a good idea for, you know, a kid from little Chesapeake, Virginia, South Norfolk, Virginia, anyway, to go to, you know, big major university like UCLA. I remember several of the coaches telling me, "Yeah, you're a small town kid. you need to go to a small town school, like, you know, maybe Norfolk State University or Virginia State or Morgan State or something like that. And, I just knew for a long time that and there's nothing wrong with Morgan State or Norfolk State or Virginia State or any of those schools. I just knew that if I was going to play college football, that I wanted to play at a higher level than those schools. And in fact, I had three sisters that graduated from Norfolk State University, and a lot of family members that went to Virginia State. My father went to Virginia State University, in fact. And so, again, nothing wrong with those schools. It's just that I had bigger idea of playing at a higher level.
Yeah. Well, you get drafted by the Seattle Seahawks. And what kind of was the atmosphere when you first got to Seattle in the early 1980s? And, I mean, what was your feelings about being drafted by them?
Well, first of all, I was very surprised to get drafted by them, and because doing the process of, I guess, where they like a combine. Back in those days, we didn't have a combine. You know, the coaches would come to the school, and they, we would get looked over and physicals and all that stuff, and so forth. And I had been told that I would probably go somewhere in the top 10 picks in a draft, and so I was really excited about that. But of the first 8 teams, of which Seattle was the number 4 pick in the draft, they never worked. They were the only team that did not work me out. I mean, I worked out for the top 8 drafting teams, and Seattle never worked me out. So I had no idea I was going to go to Seattle. In fact, the day before the draft, Bill Walsh and his entire defensive staff came down to UCLA and worked me out on Spalding Field. Worked out for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then afterwards, Bill Walsh told me to go in and take a shower. He and his entire defensive staff were going to meet me in Pauley Pavilion afterwards. And so I took a shower, came out, and we're sitting up in Pauley Pavilion. And Bill says to me, tomorrow we have the 8th pick in the first round. If you're available, we'd like to draft you. Are you okay with that? I said, absolutely. I'd love to go to San Francisco. I thought San Francisco was just on the cusp, but, you know, if they could, you know, get their defense going and so forth, that, you know, they were going to be really a fantastic team. You know, they had Dwight Clark already and Joe Montana and Freddie Solomon and, you know, a lot of really outstanding offensive players. And they just needed to get that defense going. And I thought that I could really help them. You know, they were going to play me at free safety, and that was known. And then several hours later, at whatever time the draft came on in the NFL, I mean for the NFL draft, I vividly recall, you know, Pete Rozelle. Saying with the 4th pick, the Seattle Seahawks select from UCLA, Ken Easley, and I'm saying something is wrong here. I'm supposed to be going to San Francisco, but San Francisco wanted a defensive back, and so they went across town and got the best defensive back in the land, Ronnie Lott, and Ronnie Lott had a great career for them. I think he won 3 or 4 Super Bowls. Great all-pro football player, Hall of Famer, just deserving of all the accolades that he got and he earned. When I got to Seattle, it was disappointing initially because I had my mind set on going to San Francisco, and I thought that that was going to be where I was going to be playing football the next couple of years. And I got to Seattle. Well, you know what a lot of people don't understand. When I got there in 1981, the franchise was only 5 years old. I mean, they had just come into existence, you know, 5 years earlier in 1976. So they had a lot of players that, you know, just was not very good. Now, let me tell you something now. Seattle fans have always been the greatest fans in the world. I mean, they were just as boisterous and just as vocal as they are today. And the team was not very good. I mean, basically it was a Steve Largent and Jim Zorn show. And the defense, I mean, they put up a lot of points because they were creative, and the defense just sort of hung in there. They beat teams by outscoring them because they couldn't stop anybody on defense. But when Chuck Knox came there and Jack Patera was fired in 82, I believe, and Chuck Knox came in, I think for 4 or 5 years in a row, the number one draft pick was a defensive guy. From Jeff Bryant to Terry Taylor, Jacob Green, just number ones after number ones after number one, myself. And that's how we became competitive. And the defense caught up with the offense. We got a few more offensive weapons and Kurt Warner, running back out of Penn State, and receiver Darryl Turner out of Michigan State. And Steve and Jim was still there, and Sam McCullum, and we started to put something together. And in 1983, after being in Seattle and just for 2 years, we fielded the first playoff team in Seahawk franchise history, 1983 Seahawks. We went all the way to the AFC Championship game against the L.A. Raiders at the time and lost to them in that game. But, man, I mean, we were sky high. I mean, we were really excited. Chuck Knox, that was Chuck Knox, I believe, first year. And there was nothing, absolutely nothing that was going to – that or anybody's going to tell me that 1984 we weren't going to be – right back in the same position, challenging for the Super Bowl. But unfortunately, we didn't. Fate intervened, and the team that we had beaten to get into the AFC Championship game, the Miami Dolphins, beat us in the first round in 1984.
Right, which I remember. Reading that, when you guys beat them in 83 to go to the AFC Championship, you felt like that was the most important victory of your career. Your team is definitely getting better at this point. And then in 1984, you get to showcase a little bit more of your talents at punt returner. And you had the year of your career, Defensive Player of the Year, and still put up a good playoff run. How special was that 84 season to you?
Well, it was a great season, but very disappointing. Like I said, you couldn't have told anybody on that 83 team that we weren't going to be right back in the same position, challenging for the AFC Championship game to go to the Super Bowl the next year. And we got out of the gate great. I mean, before you knew it, we had won like 8 games in a row. At the time was a club record, and I don't believe a single player on the team knew that we had won 8 games in a row. And I remember John Harris, who was our free safety, telling me one day in the locker room, we were getting ready to go out of practice, and he says, "You know, we won 8 games in a row." And I honestly did not, because we were having so much fun just winning games that we were on a high. I mean, we were just on a sky high, and we ended up losing four games that season. We were 12-4, which was also a club record at the time. And like I said, ran into a bucksaw, went back to Miami. But I'm telling you, you could not have told anybody on that football team that if we play Miami again, that we weren't going to beat them, because we were certain that we could beat Miami if we ran into them again. And unfortunately, we played them in Miami again, and after embarrassing them in '83, because they were expected to go to the Super Bowl themselves in 1983, it's probably a little bit harder to beat a team that has a mission and that's on a mission that they were in 1984. And I remember the game as if it was yesterday, because it's the only game I ever cried. I mean, like a river of tears. I mean, I could not stop crying. I was so hurt that we had lost that game, because I was so certain that we were going to win the game and be right back in position to challenge for the AFC Championship game. And we lost, and, man, I don't think I have ever been so hurt in my athletic career. I mean, ever. Absolutely ever.
All right. Right now, I'd like to remind people that our show is 45 minutes. First half hour is live. The last 15 minutes are archive time. So in about 3 minutes, the live part will cut off at midnight tonight Eastern time, which is a little over 30 minutes from now. You'll be able to catch the complete show. You can catch it on iHeartRadio, Spreaker, Blog Talk Radio, TuneIn Radio. So make sure you check out the rest of the interview here. I've got one more football question for you, Kenny, and then I want to talk about what you're doing today. You mentioned Chuck Knox. I mean, what was Chuck Knox like to play for?
Chuck was straightforward. The one thing about Chuck is that you knew where he stood, and you knew what he wanted from you, because he told you. And I appreciated that. Some people, it was an affront, when a coach would, particularly at that level, on the professional level, you don't just jump in people's face and, tell them that they're lousy or they're not playing well and so forth. But Chuck was that kind of guy. Chuck was from Swickley, Pennsylvania, and in Swickley, they didn't, I guess they didn't play much, so Chuck would get in front of your face, he'd turn his ball cap around backwards, and he was right back on the streets of Swickley, PA, and I liked that about him. I mean, I appreciated it about him, that if he didn't like something that I was doing, he would call me up in his office and say, "Hey, look, I mean, I expect more from you, and I need it, period." And I knew what that meant, get my butt in gear and give him more than what I'm giving him, if I could have given more, there were times when I couldn't give him more because I was injured. I played in too many games where I was injured. I mean, I was really hurt. I mean, I wasn't just injured, but I was hurt. And I, sucked it up and went out there and played. And I didn't play very well in those games. I bought into the hype that Ken Easley playing at half his capacity is still, better than, the other players out on the football field. I mean, that's what Chuck used to always say, to me. And so I bought into that mess. But I should have been, definitely on the bench. But that was Chuck. I mean, that was the way he got the maximum out of his people. And that's the reason why he was a successful head coach. And you know, certainly, you know, I wouldn't you know, advocate to anybody play when they're injured or when they're hurt. But there's a difference between being injured and being hurt. Being injured is you know, when you really can't get out there and do what you do normally. Being hurt, I mean everybody is hurt. I mean, after every game on Sundays, you're going to find some hurt on anybody who plays in the game, and because that's just the nature of football, you're going to get hurt. But injured is just a different thing, and I just played in, you know, too many games injured for him back in those days.
Well, it looks like you got a big celebrity golf classic coming up. I believe it's called the 5th Annual GTA, which is the Greater Trinity Academy Celebrity Golf Classic, hosted by yourself. Coming up July 22nd, going to run through July 24th. Tell us a little bit about the golf tournament that's coming up and what made you get involved with the Greater Trinity Academy charity.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen a kid in a classroom who, when he or she gets it, the energy that they display in trying to get their teacher's attention so that they can answer the question. And that's what that was the thing that got me interested in these kids, because I'd see this energy that they display when they got it, when they understood what the teacher was talking about. And that's an interesting thing to see when you see a kid who gets it. The light goes on, and you can just tell by the energy that they are exuding that they get it, and they want to tell the teacher and everybody else in the classroom that they get it. And when I was over at GTA Greater Trinity watching these kids, I was just absolutely amazed at how young these kids were and how much these kids understood about education. And it just showed me that just how powerful the mind is, and you know, how we can't take our young kids' minds for granted. Because these kids I saw kids that were 2 years old and 3 years old doing math, doing division, doing subtraction, doing multiplication at 2 and 3 years old. And I don't believe I probably learned multiplication and all that stuff, division, maybe to fifth or sixth grade, maybe. And these kids are 6 years old, and some are 3 and 4 years old, and they can do multiplication and division with the best of them. And so I just became excited about that, because I knew that these kids had a chance. These kids had a chance. And if they could just stay out of the way of trouble when they weren't in school, then these kids had a chance to be successful and to make it in life. And I figured that I would get involved to help raise money for the kids, because many of the kids were underprivileged, and they were at the school on scholarships, where various companies or businesses had supported these scholarships. So what we decided to do was to start this golf tournament, and I told the executive director that I would host it for him, and call some of my friends and former teammates and so forth, and we'll put on a golf tournament and raise some money so that we can, you know, create a scholarship opportunity for a lot of these these brilliant young kids. And so that's what we've been doing for 5 years. And I mean to tell you, every year I go back, I'm just absolutely amazed at what I see. And it's absolutely heartwarming that what we do out there on the golf course in terms of raising funds is very significant for these kids, and they appreciate it by showing us that they get it, they understand it. And when you see the kid with that type of excitement on his face, it's something that you will never forget.
Well, tell us a little bit about the celebrities who are invited to your golf tournament.
Well, this year we got Jack Thompson, the old throwing Samoan, Jack Sikma. We got Pee Wee Harrison, a former Globetrotter. Sidney Rice, who played for the Vikings and the Seahawks. Jay Buhner, my former neighbor, by the way, who played for the Mariners. Kurt Warner, former Seahawks running back. Tony Brothers, NBA referee, who still referees today. Sean Kemp, former Sonic. Blair Bush, Charlie Young, Joe Tufour, Edwin Bailey. Just a whole plethora of great guys that come out and devote their time and energy to these kids, and I just really appreciate all of them that come out and help us out.
Are there any other events that you'd like everyone to know about? They're going to be at the tournament. Sorry.
Yeah, on Wednesday, the 23rd, July 23rd, we have a celebrity welcome, a celebrity and sponsor welcome dinner at Novelty Hill Winery. That'll start at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, July 23rd. Open to the public. I forgot what the fee is to get in, but it's something minimal. And then on Thursday, that's Wednesday, July 22nd. On Thursday, July 23rd, we have our celebrity shootout, where we have 15 celebrities over 9 holes. Last 3 guys standing play the final 3 holes, 16, 17, and 18, for the shootout championship, which is a fun deal. That's the real golf that we play, because you have to play your own ball, and that's a lot of fun. And then
do you play in the golf tournament yourself, Kenny?
I have in the past. I haven't played the last 2 years. I mean, I've been to the tournament. I didn't play the last 2 years, but I'm going to try to play this year. So I'm looking forward to it. I haven't played in a couple of years. So Thursday night we have a live concert featuring Kalimba, which is a tribute band to Earth, Wind, and Fire. And if you like the Earth, Wind, and Fire from the 70s, then this group is as good as it's going to get to be Earth, Wind, to not be the real thing. These guys are really fantastic musicians, and they absolutely do great justice to the legendary group Earth, Wind, and Fire. And then on Friday, July – beg your pardon?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Yeah, then on Friday, July 24th, is the actual celebrity golf event at Willow's Run in Redmond, Washington. So we got a full week of stuff, and looking forward to it. Looking forward to seeing the kids, and looking forward to seeing all the celebrity players, and very thankful to all of the sponsors that support the GTA Classic. But I need to also say, you know, that give a shout out to my Dynamite golf staff led by Charles Biggers and the irrepressible Nims Scarum. They are just a fantastic group of people that that do this uncompensated, and no one on the staff gets, you know, gets paid a dime, but we probably put on one of the tournaments in the Northwest every year, and so very excited, you know, and very happy for our golf committee because they've put together another outstanding event for 2015.
Well, it sounds like a great time, a great event for a great cause. We got to be wrapping this up. We're almost out of time. So is there a website people can go to get all this information also?
Yeah, they can go to www.kennyeasleygolf.com. And all of that stuff that I just mentioned is right there on the website as well.
All right. Well, hey, it was truly an honor to have you on. Like I said, you were one of my favorite players when I was younger. I mean, it's really great to hear the things you're doing in your community to make a difference. It would be great if everybody would do that, athletes, regular people, anybody that can get out there and help. Anybody can go to Kenny Easley. Remember, it's www.kennyeasleygolf.com, and I believe that starts next week. Matt, you got any closing questions or comments?
Kenny, I'd just like to say thank you again very much for being with us tonight. Like Mike said, you were also one of my very favorite players growing up, and got to see you. And I always enjoy watching you play, and it's really great to hear about the things that you're doing today.
Well, thank you, Matt. And I also want to thank you because I didn't know until just probably a couple of days ago that because my youngest daughter sent me an article that she had found in a newspaper from this fellow named Matt. I can't pronounce your last name. And
nobody can, Kenny. Don't worry about it.
And I read the article, and I said, well, that's interesting. It was very nice of him to do that because, you know, I've been out of the game for, you know, a long time, and certainly, you know, there was probably no reason for him to write the article. And but because, you know, you decided to write the article, and you wrote it very well. I thought it was very well done. And all the facts were in line, and so I want to thank you for doing that because it certainly was enjoyable for my daughter to read, because she wasn't born when I was playing football, and so she can only look at pictures and stuff like that about my playing days. But when she reads stuff that people say, you know, nicely about my career, then it really makes her feel good. And so she shared it with all of her classmates up at school at Howard University. And so thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That's an honor. It was an honor to write it, and I'm truly honored that you were able to read it and enjoyed it. I appreciate that.
Well, like I said, we're out of time, so thanks again to Kenny Easley for being on the show. Matt, that was a good interview. And, you know, he gave props out to your Sports Rants article. He even said it was well-written, which, you know, I know you got an editor. But
thanks, Mike.
So remember, you can hear all of our shows now on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher. We are, you know, global. Because we, you know, probably the best sports talk show you'll ever hear, but but make sure you join us next Tuesday night for the Grueling Truth Boxing Show. We'll be back next Thursday for the Grueling Truth Football Show. So for my co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage, who I know how to pronounce his name because I've known him a long time, I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and we will see you guys next week. You've been listening to the Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.